Hello, my name is Sarah Tulloch, Talking Writing's podcast production manager, and this is the Talking Writing Podcast. This week, we're speaking to Angie Alita Noel. She belongs to the Lilikwe First Nation from the Decho, the place where the two rivers meet. As a trained historian, she blends a tradition of oral stories with academic history and holds university degrees in English literature, creative writing, and First Nations history with an emphasis on colonialism. Angie is a heavily tattooed global wanderer, a mother to daughters, and a connoisseur of coffee. She has a profound appreciation for humanity and what we as a people can instill in this awe-inspiring world. Her book, All I See Is Violence, weaves love, loss, and hard truths into a story that needs to be told, a journey through violence to bear witness to all that was taken, honoring what all of our ancestors lived through, and to heal by acknowledging the shadows in order to find the light. Please enjoy the episode, and keep an eye out for the bonus episode coming out next Monday, where we discuss Angie's writing process. Hello, and welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. My name is Sarah Tulloch, and I am the podcast production manager. And today we have Angie Noel with us today. We're going to be talking about her book that's releasing in January, I believe, right?
Yes, January 16th.
January 16th. It's All I See Is Violence, and it's a historical fiction about the Battle of Little Bighorn and all the repercussions that came from it in the 70s. And I have to say, I was completely obsessed. As soon as I started reading it, I was like, oh my God, there's so much happening. So
I'm so happy. I was actually wondering if you read it. I was like, well, that would be weird if she wanted to talk to me if you didn't read it.
I had the article a while ago.
Give you a synopsis.
If you want to do like a quick summary of All I See Is Violence, just from your perspective, what is the book about?
Okay, for me, it was like we deconstructed the Battle of Little Bighorn. Like there's like Native Americans, like we're so projected upon. I wanted to write something that felt more authentic. And so I'm trained as a historian. So I use my archival research to kind of weave like actual, you know, historical events into one story. And it was mind blowing how much happened in like such a short period of time in American history. I was like, this is unbelievable. You couldn't make that up.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how it felt. It felt like so much was happening all at once that I just binged the whole thing in like a few days. So yeah. I wanted to ask, what drew you to write All I See Is Violence and the Battle of Little Bighorn? Was there something that stuck out to you that had you create this, or what happened there?
For me, it was a Cheyenne elder. I was at a Musqueam feast at UBC, the University of British Columbia, and this gentleman, he just turned to me and he said, did you know there were women warriors? And I was like, what? Like, I never thought about that. And here I was, trained as a historian. I'm trained in colonial history. And I had never really come across that. And so that one statement, I started like weaving through documents. And sure enough, like there it was. Like almost half the warriors in all these battles were women.
Yeah. And it was so interesting to see her. I mean, I see her in my mind's eye, I read about it, but like covered in red and then the regalia and everything was just so, it was so vivid to read. I felt like I could just see everything. It was incredible.
That was the other thing. They make them look so beige, like when you see like cinematic depictions of Indigenous people. And it like when you start like actually looking through like archival research and like looking through like their ethnographic sort of like paintings that they depicted, like there's so much color. Like these people were tattooed with crazy piercings and librettes, and like all that's just kind of been almost like how we view like Grecian statues as just like, you know, marble white, but at one point they were painted, right? So like, it's like, whoa, like somehow this became very colorless.
Yeah, you definitely put the color back into the history of it.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other thing was like, they adopted a lot of colonial technology, like a lot of the clothing, like at this point in time, like they're, you know, they're wearing like trousers with a vest and, you know, they got their gun with some arrows, like it's a real mishmash going on. So to say like, oh, that was really compartmentalized and like, there was tons of intermarrying between like, you know, non-Indigenous people and Indigenous people, between like, you know, people of African descent, people of European descent. So we have a real, you know, there's a real it's a real mixing pot. And so they would draw from those cultures as well, right? And it would just all kind of, you know, it was just really fascinating, like really, really fascinating that that kind of had been, you know, omitted. And I was like, oh, we got to put that back in there.
Yeah, it was incredible to see. It was incredible to read. And I just felt like I learned so much. And this goes into the next question of like, these are a lot of facts that were being fed in a fiction format. Why did you write in a historical fiction novel, rather than writing a nonfiction book?
Well, one, it's more exciting. I don't know if you read much nonfiction, but whew, you want like a good sleep, like crack open a history book. I mean, there's the odd one. Like I used, for Custer, I used T.J. Stiles' Custer's Trials. And that's an extraordinary book, like for nonfiction, like it's engrossing and you're like really captivated. That's not the norm. And then my other thing was I wanted to make it accessible. Like I'm a mother to daughters. Like I was like, how can I get them to engage in this history in like, you know, a really pragmatic way that's not, you know. you're like, I don't know if I care. Like history's so important. Like, you know, the past, like it dictates our present. Mm-hmm. Like all those things, like, you know, like they're still affecting us presently.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like especially when we cut to the 70s, Nancy, her story, when you see how everything kind of just unfolds so far into the future. And then to make the connection that they were related of Little Wolf or related by marriage, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And then that was crazy too, because like the Battle of Little Bighorn and that standoff is all in the same spot. Yeah. It's like, that is crazy. There's something going on with that location.
Yeah. Again, I binged it. So I was just so obsessed with how the fighting went out and then to cut to Angie and, or not Angie, you're Angie, to cut to Nancy. And okay. I have another question I'm thinking of, but that's going to come up later. So I wanted to ask also, you had a perspective of General Custer, like you said, what was your intentions and like, why did you put him in there? Because when I first read it, I was like, what is he doing here? Like,
I was just like really fascinated. Like, I believe in like a universal oneness, like we're all connected. So I don't think he was necessarily like a bad person. It actually, when I started researching him, I started feeling a little bit embarrassed because he like essentially like pretended to be an Indian. You know, he's wearing the buckskin and he thinks he's like a chief. And like, it's really quite bizarre. He goes on like a couple like buffalo hunts and it's, you know, he's got like Bloody Knife, his scout that, but yet like he still thinks he's above them racially. So it's, you know, there's this real like dichotomy and this tension with him. And I wanted to put him in there just because I wanted that sort of juxtaposition, like that sort of tension, like what was their perspective and what was our perspective? And let's kind of like meet in the middle.
Yeah. You definitely made his motivations more clear because you get the facts of like, oh, it's for his country and it's for his idea of like race theory and all that. But to see it played out and have his wife there as well and his brothers and everything, it's like, dang, this was like his whole life, huh?
You couldn't make that up. The whole family was slaughtered. I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, you felt bad for him. You were like, this is unbelievable. Could you imagine living through that? And they went in so cocky. Like they were like, oh, we're going to like, just like, you know, take it to these people. We got our Gatling guns and we have our advanced artillery. And then it just like all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
And it was like Crazy Horse too. Like you have him, he's like a madman. He's like, his wife killed himself a few years previous to that and he just like mentally unravels. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have him running into bullets and like it's like, again, you couldn't make it up. And like from what I researched, Crazy Horse, like he's like, he had blonde hair. So I was like, well, what's going on here? Like, why do we always depict him so dark when, like, you know, you start looking through these photos and you're like, oh, okay, like, we have curly hair, we have blonde hair. Like, why are we always have, like, long, dark hair? Like, why?
I should have looked him up, but did you find out like why he has blonde hair? Like, is that like a...
I couldn't tell if like maybe like for when I started looking into it, because I was like, well, it looks like the Eastern indigenous people are just naturally lighter. They're taller and lighter. And then like the more kind of like, you know, like where I'm from in the Northwest Territories, like we're super dark. Like we have dark hair, dark eyes, like unless you're, you know, from like an interracial family, like you don't come out light. But it looks like over there, like, you know, it looks like, yeah, that's, you know, they have smoky eyes and they're tall and they're fair featured. Like, and the more west you go, you know, the darker people get and the shorter. Yeah, there's a real variance. There's not like one, like each nation's so different. Like even linguistically, like I'm right now living in the province of British Columbia, and there's like 100 different languages, and they're as different as German and Japanese. So we have like vastly different cultures that you can't kind of homogenize. And at this point in colonial history, like we're trying to homogenize people, and it's not working, because like the tribes, one, don't like each other. You know, then they're not the same. So it's like, you know, it would be like putting like Guatemala and Thailand, like they'd be like, whoa, like what are we doing here?
Yeah. I feel like you could see that, especially when I believe it was the crows that got involved in the battle. And I was like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah, they were like, you know, because they're like, oh, we're going to take it to them. Like, we're going with these people. Like, we have like legitimate beef that we're going to like sort out here. And you kind of see that the whole way through, right? You see it from like the American Revolution onwards, like this sort of like tribal politics getting played out. Like, they switch sides. Like, it's, you know, like this is a 400 year fight where they're trying to take over all the indigenous land, and it's still ongoing. Like, it's not like, it's like, oh, nope. Like reservations, like that's, you know, that's disputed.
There was a line, I believe, at the very end, and I wanted to ask for cultural context of this. There was a line that was like, the Supreme Court admitted that they were wrong for ruining all those treaties, and they had like $2 trillion in the bank for the surviving Native American. Is Native Americans a good term to use, or Indian is used a lot in the book?
You know, I kind of just like them all. It's weird how there's so many names. So I just kind of like, you know, depending on like how it feels in the sentence.
So correct me if I say anything wrong, but there's maybe $2 trillion, I think I remember, in the bank for any natives who want to accept it, and no one has accepted it yet. Could I?
Oh, with the Sears. So that's up in Black Hills, and so they were like, yeah, we like I kind of touched. I think I went into that, like they violated the treaty, the Laramie Treaty. And they were like, you know, like, okay, you get to keep the Black Hills because those are sacred. But they're like, oh shit, there's gold. You know, like, no, we take that back. We're going to need that land. And so that's where this like big struggle is coming, right? Mm-hmm. You have this real tension. And then they're trying to say like, no, you're not allowed to like be on your land anymore. You have to go live in an allocated, you know, allotment of land. You can no longer hunt. You can no longer self-sustain. You're fully dependent on what we have to offer for you. So that's, I mean, I wouldn't like that if someone said that to me. I don't know if I would be as feisty as those people, but anyways, so that's just specifically over the Black Hills. Is it a trillion or is it in the billions? But it's a lot of money, and no one's withdrawn any because they want the land. They don't want the money.
Because I was wondering, I was like, is there, because I believe his name is Timothy, fights in DC, and he's like trying to create this like, or in, what's the word, add to this political kind of uprising kind of movement to try and help his own people. And I wanted to ask if there's any interest in, I'm sure there's still interest, like it's your land, right? But like, is there anything like happening currently to like trade the money that's in there for the actual land?
Oh, I think there's been like all sorts of litigation. Again, like each tribe, like each nation, like they're so varied in what they want. Like, you know, they literally spend like millions and millions of dollars in like the different judicial systems, like in Canada and the United States, trying to, you know, figure it out. So, I mean, I just don't know why we all can't get along. Yeah, that fascinated me too, is that like my mother, who was Nancy, she passed, but she was an Air Force pilot in the Royal Canadian Armed Forces. And we have a real strong military background as a people. Like these people, they didn't like get conscripted into Vietnam. Like they volunteered, same with World War, II, World War I. You have the Navajo like Windtalkers, you have the Comanche Windtalkers. Like we have, so like, you know, even though what's been done to us is horrific, like we're still willing to participate.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's kind of interesting too, right? It's like, well,
there's so many questions, but you just dropped a bomb on me that I didn't think I knew. You said that Nancy is your mom.
I based her upon my biological mother. Yeah, she passed a long time ago, like probably 30 years now. So
yeah. So then what about Nancy in the book was actual history? Because from what I read, I don't know if her daughter survived, but you're here. So
no, I don't think the daughter did survive, but she did have four sons. So there wasn't too many similarities there, except for, you know, both the Nancys are incredibly strong women who, you know, could go it as a single mom. Who my mother was incredibly smart. She graduated from high school at 15, like Doogie Howser smart, yeah. And she was, you know, she was like small with a lot of tenacity. There's a couple of great pictures of her. So she ends up going into the military quite young in Canada. She ends up going just shy of 18. So she starts like going to the education portion of it at 17, 18. And then she really liked guns. So that's where that trickled in a little of my... So yeah, there's all sorts of pictures of her, you know, smoking cigarettes with like big guns, my mom. So again, like that's not like... We're kind of getting into like gender, right? Because like our perception of like indigenous cultures match were linearly based. So like if I were to get married, then, you know, the person that I married would take my name and come into my community. It wouldn't be, you know, whereas in colonial culture, we're kind of living in now, we're kind of coming out of that as real, it's a real patriarchy, right? Like we have like, you know, you can even see it in our political systems, right? We got like that.
Yeah.
We got the guys at the top. Whereas, you know, we kind of had, you know, we had like, it was a real, it was even. Like we understood there was differences, obviously, and like they should be celebrated, like different feminine qualities. Like, you know, women can give life. Like that's huge. Yeah. But I mean, they could still mount a horse and go to war. Like that was, you know, that was just like normal. Like, yep, you're good at that.
And shoot Custer in the face.
Yeah.
Following that, I wanted to ask a little bit about like the gender kind of situation that's happening, because it seems like in Little Wolf's sections, there was a lot of reverence for the women in like the community, and they were always, it seems like, always treated with respect, and they were encouraged to have their rituals and their time alone and their time together. Like, but then when we get to Nancy, it seems like every man besides Joshua is like against her. And I'm like, can you give her a break? Like, what is going on here? Like, can you give cultural context to how the gender dynamics kind of shifted in the last few years?
For sure. Like colonialism's been hard on Indigenous people, and like the men in our community have been really emasculated through the different, you know, you could really only call them genocidal policies.
Yeah.
You know, the residential school, and like because they wanted to crush us so badly, like they made the men feel bad for themselves for the way they treated our women, which was nice. You know, it was full of, like you said, like reverence, respect, like, you know, there was, you know, they understood like everyone had a role, but it wasn't necessarily a conventional role. You know, we weren't expected to put on a corset and like just sit around and drink tea. Like it wasn't, you know, and you know, the colonial women, like when you get into like a, like the homesteaders, like they had a hard life too, you know, but they were still like expected to carry on those traditional like feminine roles. Like they weren't, you know, you had like the men out there, you know, however you would call that, like sighing the hay, and like, you know, the women were alongside too. So I, you know, it's just been really interesting watching, and you're kind of seeing like, I don't know if we're coming out of that. Like are women, like you always hear like, oh, women aren't making as much, or like, as, I don't know if that, is that true? Like, you don't know what to believe. Like, so I know like in Indigenous community, like we have a lot of problems with domestic violence. We have a lot of problems with sexual violence, and it stems from these policies, these colonial policies of residential schools. So I don't know if you're familiar with that. I didn't go into it with this book, but the book I'm writing now, I'm working on Geronimo, and we get into the boarding schools or residential schools. So there's a 100-year policy in Canada and the United States where they forcibly take Indigenous children and they place them in boarding schools. So they take them away from their parents for the whole year and they re-educate them. In, you know, a colonial fashion, they're not allowed to speak their language. They're told culturally, like, that's wrong. They're physically abused. They're experimented on. They're murdered. Like, it's, you know, we have a big problem. Like, we're finding mass graves, and there's a lot of confusion around that. No one wants to admit what's happened, but it like, to move forward, we have to kind of look at this and be like, okay, this has happened. This isn't right. Like, how do we heal? Like, we all have to just come together and be like, admit that, you know, this is a great injustice. Like, let's, you know, move forward.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Do you know when your next book will be coming out?
Probably next year. So the second part of this goes to Geronimo, and Geronimo is quite the character. And so he worked with the medicine woman, Lozen, who, you know, they both appeared to have magical capabilities. We had those who could like predict, like remote view and predict where the army was. So that's how they evade the U.S. military for 20 years. And you got Geronimo, who appears to be able to summon storms. So, I mean, Geronimo's a wild guy. Like his whole family's murdered by the Mexican army. He just like mentally unhinges. Like it's just crazy. Like what he gets into, and then he ends up, you know, surrendering to the reservation, and his kids are taken and put in Carlisle, which is that really iconic, horrific American boarding school. And he ends up like as like a show piece at like the World's Fair, and he ends up like drunk in a ditch, dead. Like it's just like the craziest, most tragic story to see like this like warrior kind of like, you know, try to navigate that system. He wasn't murdered though, like the U.S. military murdered like Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, you know, like all those big chiefs. Somehow Geronimo just like, you know, with Geronimo's story too, you get Magnus Colorado and you get Cochise, which were also two really big chiefs that they end up murdering as well. Cochise, I think, dies of stomach cancer, which is, you know, I don't think they diagnosed it as cancer then, but there's something wrong with his stomach, definitely.
Yeah.
Magnus Colorado, they, cut off his head and they boil it, and I think it's at the Smithsonian now. Because he was like really physically fit, so he, you know, he led as a war chief into his 70s. Like, wow. You look at some of like our politicians are in their 70s, you're like, do you think they could mount a horse? And no.
Bro, you obviously have so much knowledge. You're so well read about everything, all these facts. I'm like blown away. How did you decide what to keep in the novel and what to leave behind? Because it feels like there's so much. Like, what was that process like?
Oh, I'll show you. If I could get it on the sheet of paper.
Oh my gosh.
It's
like my old study guides. Like,
and then we had to go onto the back because we had so many storylines.
Yeah. Wow. And this organized you.
Yeah. So yeah. And then I would just refer back to it as I was writing. And because as a writer, it's easy to get lost. You get like off, like I'm a wordy person. So like, it was hard to keep it as short as I did. And so if it wasn't on here and I was getting off topic, I had to delete it. Maybe I had to just like, nope, like we can't go there. That'll have to be another novel.
Was there anything that you had cut that you would really, really wanted to keep in, or was it easy to make cuts like that?
I think like once you get like, so like you end up essentially doing like six drafts. Like you write out like the first one, then you go back through it and like it kind of like grows. And by the time you get to like before you actually query it to send to a publisher, I think that's when like you have to get really serious as a writer and be like, you want to show like a snapshot, right? It's almost like you're like a voyeur as like a reader. You just want to see like a screenshot. So it's like, well, is this a screenshot or am I kind of just like rambling on? And you can tell when there's a ramble on, there's like, you know, kind of run on sentences and it feels forced.
Okay. That's good. That's a good tip because I feel like I'm rambling currently in my own novel. So I'm like,
it's good to let the ramble in the draft, like let yourself ramble. And then like when you go through, you can just feel it. You're just like, oh, like that's not a chorus.
Okay. That's a good tip. There are a few themes, but something that's like very overt is the themes between like life and death and happiness and despair. It's all about them, but I'm thinking more about Little Wolf and Nancy and how Little Wolf had this amazing moment of her marriage and she's included in the community, and then I'm not going to spoil it, but the ending is like has some despair to it. And then Nancy, she has this moment with Joshua and it looks like things are getting better, and then she has her moments of despair too. So I wanted to ask how you balanced that as a writer. Like how did you, because I feel like it was balanced, I feel like it was like realistic, but you know what's coming kind of because it's history. Like how did you balance life and death and happiness and despair?
You know, I was really inspired by like modern literature. Like I love modern literature, like T.S. Eliot, like the World War I poet, like Wilfred Owen. I love like, you know, William Shakespeare and Ernest Hemingway. And they do like a really nice job of, you know, juxtapositioning, like, you know, that's essentially life, right? Like we have like these really triumphant, momentous moments where it's just like pure bliss. And then, yeah, like you can have just like complete and utter tragedies where it seems like you're never going to get back up. And for me, I wanted to show, like, I wanted to illustrate like what it felt like for Little Wolf getting ripped from her, or like essentially like all she knew, right? We're forced onto a reservation. Like what is that loss of losing your home? Like they're essentially now prisoners, right? Like the reservation's a prison camp.
Yeah.
Like we can't, you know, and they still, like, it's still like that now. Like I don't live on a reservation, so you're not entitled to a lot of rights. You lose them. So it's, you know, you have to make some big decisions as an Indigenous person, and you have to walk away from, you know, your community, because now your community is only allowed in this one area. So how, you know, like I want to illustrate like the loss there. And for Nancy, I wanted to show like the repercussions and like the destruction within our own community, right? At this point, like substance abuse issues are so rampant and horrific. Like I've experienced that in my own personal family. Like it just rips everyone apart, and it's not something like you just kind of like get over. It's something you have to learn to live with.
Yeah. That, just because I wanted a little bit of clarification, is that what happened with Timothy? Because they implied it, but I wasn't super sure.
For sure. I think Vietnam, like from when I started researching Vietnam, like it seems like a lot of people got hooked on drugs there. Like they were, you know, they're kind of handing them out like party favors, right? Like all sorts of stuff. Like we got like hallucinogens, you got like cocaine, you got like, you know, really like souped up pot, like all sorts of, like that was a crazy, horrific war. I can see why like we're all like, let's not talk about that. And like, you know, we still have people who fought in that war that are alive today, and like they deserve a lot of respect.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it. this whole conversation was amazing.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I would love to read what you've written.
Oh, when it's ready, because I'm scared. Eventually. Okay. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being on the Talking Writing Podcast. We really appreciate you. And we can purchase your book in stores and online January 16th?
16th. And you can pre-order it now on Amazon.
Amazing. Everybody go pre-order. Thank you so much, Angie.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.